You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the first Times Higher Education issue review podcast of 2014 for the edition covering the 2nd to the 8th of January. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, news editor Simon Baker and reporter Jack Grove. University vice chancellors in Russell Group institutions pocketed substantial pay rises when £9,000 tuition fees were introduced, according to new figures. Jack will talk about that in a second. Our cover feature this week offers some insights into the difficulties faced by academics affected by the UK's visa regime. And a study shows some of the extreme tactics being used by lecturers to manage rowdy students. That's coming up too. But first and foremost, Jack, your splash this week looks at vice chancellors' pay levels.
Yes, well, I've been having a look at some of the annual accounts that university publish around this time of year. And in these accounts, you'll find the pay of the top paid people in universities, particularly the vice chancellors. And every year at the Times Higher, we look at the pay of vice chancellors, and this is a little snapshot of the Russell Group, which is the 24 research intensive universities that make up that prestigious group. And I've found that the average salary rose by £22,000 in 2012-13, which is when £9,000 tuition fees came in. And overall pay, which includes pensions, rose to £318,500. So that's a 8% rise in salaries and a 5.2% rise in overall benefits. And that would compare that would be far greater than the 1% national rise given to rank and file staff that year. And they were given and accepted in the end a 1% pay offer. Some of them got increments on top of that. And this year they've been offered the same 1%, and they're currently on strike. They're doing a series of one-day strikes that have taken place in October and December and will doubtless continue into the new year.
Well, if these figures are anything to go by, they'll have plenty of reason to, won't they?
Well, we've previously reported on the... it's interesting, isn't it? Because with pay, there's always this argument that, you know, universities aren't really public sector, but public sector pay restraint is kind of, you know, in place across the board, but that universities actually, a lot of them, find themselves with more cash in the bank than they've ever had, really. So, I mean, that would be the union's argument for, you know, that some of these surpluses that are being racked up and some of the increased income that universities are getting from tuition fees should be being handed on. And vice chancellors will say, well, you know, we can't really do that just because we've had a couple of bumper years. But you do look at some of these pay increases and say they're really undermining their own argument here. And that's probably why we had a story, didn't we, at the end of last year where a couple of vice chancellors, I think Paul Curran, who leads negotiations on behalf of UCEA, and also Simon Gaskell at Queen Mary, did turn down pay increases, and they were quite careful when they said that was a personal decision, and they weren't sort of saying that other vice chancellors should do the same. But you're in a much stronger position to make the case that for sort of wider pay restraint if you're showing it yourself. And when you look at some of these figures, I mean, the one that jumps off the page, well, the couple that jump off the page, you know, Steve West at UWE getting a £52,000 increase, including half of that being performance-related bonus, and Craig Calhoun getting £466,000, including a one-off £88,000 relocation stipend. And you might say, well, you know, the LSE response is that they've, you know, benchmarked and decided this was the appropriate salary, but you look at what Howard Davies, who's a very senior, very respected and sort of, you know, really quite high profile guy who was running the LSE previously, and he was on £285,000. What's the real, you know, how can they justify such a discrepancy?
It does seem to be a bit of a race to the top in terms of benchmarking, and
I mean, the trouble is they use international comparators, don't they?
Exactly.
So they look at American universities and they look at some of the salaries earned by presidents over there, and they think, well, we're the Russell Group, we should be comparing ourselves with the top American universities, and so that you get that kind of arms race, don't you? Yeah. It's the same with tuition fees, I suppose.
But I mean, I think it must be quite galling for general academics when they're being told that they just have to, and they were told at this time, 2012-13 is going to be a tumultuous year, we don't know what's going to happen, you're going to have to accept a 1% pay offer below inflation for the fourth year running. Mm. And then this is what's happening at the top, and they might argue that it's being decided in a different way, but
it'll be interesting to see how this when Jack, you do the wider sector-wide VC pay piece that we always do later in the year. It'll be interesting to see whether this is mirrored across the sector, or whether it is just the Russell Group who are, as you say, Simon, benchmarking themselves against kind of, you know, the US elite that they're trying to emulate. Yeah. Or whether it's sort of a wider trend across the sector.
Well, I suppose Steve West is just one, but seems to suggest that there are some bigger increases elsewhere. But I suppose the one thing to remember is that these are from the year before, aren't they? They're not this year, they're 12-13,
right,
and the pay row is going on now. Although don't you start to get the feeling that, you know, this year, you know, they're pushing it just one year too far when they're asking for a low pay rise for everyone.
Well, these figures reflect the really bumpy year in 2011, just before the fees, when student numbers were at a record high. And they dropped, actually, in this year when the pay was actually given out. But they're back up again, so I don't really see why these pay rises are going to tail off at any point.
The thing about the general pay route I just wanted to mention is that, you know, we just had the CBI calling on him, you know, employers to pay, possibly start thinking about paying their staff more. So, you know, that's not going to undermine their argument as well. But it's general staff.
So think about, I mean, these are, you know, there are remuneration committees that decide how much these executives should be being paid, and it's down to the individual vice chancellors if they say that we don't want to take this, as Simon Gaskell did, and it's quite hard, however well heeled you are, to turn around and say, actually, that £50,000 I'm being offered, I think I'll leave that, thanks.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah, page 6 for that story. The Vice Chancellor's Pay survey we do every year as well is available on the data section of our website that you can click to from our homepage. That'll be last year's, obviously, but we'll update that as and when the figures are in. The cover feature this week, John, maybe back to you, insights into some of the difficulties faced by academics who are affected by the UK's visa routine. Some quite personal stories this week.
Yeah, I think that was the point of what we were trying to do here. I mean, you hear so much about the difficulties that scholars and students face with the sort of visa crackdown that we've had over the last couple of years. And undoubtedly, you know, the numbers are very, very striking and the kind of the wider angst about it. But sometimes it helps to have a few of the actual individual stories of how people's personal lives have been affected to really draw that out. So we've just pulled out two or three really interesting stories of people who've been hit quite hard. I mean, there's a Canadian academic who has been over here for quite some time and working and studying. And the ways in which she's been messed around, her career has been, you know, really affected. She's had jobs offered to her and then withdrawn because of the way that the visa regime has changed. She's been left, she says, feeling that actually this is a country that doesn't value her services and doesn't want her here. So, I mean, it's quite striking to actually read those personal stories and see what the effect on the individuals can be. And, I mean, one of the interesting lines, I think, in this particular Canadian academic's the way she tells the story is that she feels that the government, as she puts it, speaking out of both sides of its mouth. And what she means by that is that on the one hand they're saying we want the brightest and the best, we want the top scholars from around the world to come here, but on the other hand they're busy shutting those doors and slamming the doors in people's faces. And actually this is the kind of contradiction that we've seen at the heart of government over the last year or two, with the Home Office being completely at odds with the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills in the way it approaches visas and the way that policy is drawn up, and just not having a really sensible, coherent approach to making it a place where, you know, top scholars can come and feel welcome.
Ties in quite nicely, actually, with another feature we've got this week, isn't it, in the opinion section, where some of our columnists nominate their alternative honours list. Theresa May is nominated by Christopher Bixby for, and I quote, contributions to persistence beyond reason. I think that's possibly tying in something with what you're saying there.
That's right, yeah. I mean, Theresa May has obviously been the kind of architect of this Home Office policy. I mean, to be fair to her, she inherited this target to reduce net migration and has gone about it very assiduously. But, I mean, the alternative New Year's Honours list that we have this year does kind of detail some of the quite extraordinary policies that she's overseen in the last couple of years. It's also quite an extraordinary feature because it puts Theresa May, Miley Cyrus and Stefan Collini on the same page. So I don't think you've seen that anywhere else.
That's never happened before. No, well, page 32 for the cover feature and page 24 for that alternative honours list this week. Do check them out. Finally, a study, Simon, covered in this week's news section, shows some of the tactics that lecturers are using to manage rowdy students. What's this all about?
This is quite interesting story that we picked up from the Society for Research into Higher Education conference last month, and there was a presentation there about some research by Carolyn Jackson, professor in the Department of Educational Research at Lancaster University, and she looked at some lectures and interviewed students and academics at a large post-92 institution. She was just investigating really whether there were what kind of tactics lecturers were being forced to use to kind of keep order in the class, really. And she had some very surprising results, really, and it kind of ties in with some of the research that NUS have done on lad culture in universities, because it seems, unfortunately, the male students seem to be the most rowdy when it comes to the lectures and some of this research. But there's some surprising kind of results in that, showing that some tactics that you normally might find in a primary school.
So, really. Chaz, what was it?
Naughty steps?
I don't know if it's gone as far as naughty steps, but there's red and yellow cards being issued to try and curb behaviour, and that's something I've definitely seen in primary schools, other sort of kind of behaviour that was observed, sort of generally being sort of loud in classes, being joking around, throwing things about, arriving late, rude and disrespectful to lecturers, and this might ring true of a lot of kind of people's academics personal experience. But it's just a interesting insight into kind of the modern lecture hall in some universities.
Mm. And as we get more and more students, of course, that could become more of an issue. We've got David Willetts writing this week.
I mean, the idea behind this piece, we actually commissioned it because David Willetts has spoken at length about there being a chapter of the white paper from a couple of years ago, which he was very keen on, but which hit the cutting room floor, which was about the public benefits of higher education. So we asked him to sort of revive that for us, really, and write a bit about it. But actually, as so often when you commission a piece, he's kind of, you know, he's been overtaken by events slightly, and it's a really interesting analysis by David Willetts of the sort of student number cap being lifted and what that might mean for the sector. So that's well worth a read as well this week.
Absolutely. Well, read all of those stories and more in this week's Times Higher Education. If you want to comment on any of them, you can do so via our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Twitter and on Google+. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.